Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Denise Michaud, co-chair of the Grownups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our program tonight is the fundamental challenge of planning your estate. What's fair in family inheritance? And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panelists. Ruth Dixon Mueller, PhD. She lives in the Bay Area and is a former professor of sociology at UC Davis. She has published widely on topics relating to families and women's rights. Her newest work is called Passing On, What's Fair in Family Inheritance. Frederick Hertz is an attorney mediator based in Oakland. His practice focuses on resolving financial and property disputes surrounding inheritance, co-ownership, and divorce in traditional and non-traditional families. John O'Grady is our moderator today. He has spoken at the Commonwealth Club several times. He's a favorite speaker of ours. He has been practicing trust and estate law and mediation in San Francisco for more than 25 years. Please welcome our panelists.
Thank you, Denise. I'm John O'Grady, and I'll have the privilege of moderating today. And a few preliminary things. One is that we're not going to be providing legal advice tonight. This is general information. And, you know, estate planning, inheritance can be viewed from several perspectives. You know, there's the psychological perspective, the philosophical, historical, and Ruth and Fred have their perspectives. Ruth is a sociologist and wrote the book on equality in estate planning from the perspective of a sociologist. Fred is a mediator of inheritance battles. Yes. Fred has a lot of experience mediating the nasty estate battles that affect more and more families these days. And so they provide these two perspectives. And tonight we're going to ask you to hold questions to the end, and we'll let you know when it's question time. And when question time comes, we won't have a whole lot of time for questions, and we're not going to be able to like respond to your specific family drama. So try to keep your questions real questions and not speeches. That'd be great. Thanks. And we'll be around after the program to answer your questions as long as necessary. And so before we begin, you should each have three handouts. And before I forget, I want to say that I have a popular newsletter about these things. If you'd like to sign up for it here, I'll pass around the sign-up sheet. Here's a pen. Yes, there's two. Oops. Thank you. And Ruth. Ruth, would you say something, give us an orientation to the kind of social sciences perspective of equality in estate planning, and the kind of some of the thought and conflicts that go into it historically?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And thanks very much for everyone for being here. Equality is one dimension of what we're going to be talking about. We're also going to be talking about when inequality, treating people differently, is a better method of planning your estate. That's going to be one of our major tensions that arise. I'd like to begin, actually, by saying that if we wouldn't be here to talk about fairness if we weren't subject to the laws of our country, which allow us pretty much total freedom to decide in our wills who we'd like to give our assets to, our property to, how much we want to give them, who we want to include. That involves our capacity, if we wish, to disinherit our children, give all our money to save the whales, even if we have a big family. We actually have what is almost complete, what's called testamentary freedom. And testamentary, of course, we talk about our last will and testament, right? Testament meaning a kind of to testify. We testify in front of witnesses that this is how we're going to dispose of our property. And it's a kind of a social contract that we make with our personal representatives who have to carry out our wishes after we've died, and the beneficiaries that we've named. So where did this idea come from? We take it for granted that we have this freedom, but it's actually, if you look around the world, rather an unusual situation, because in most countries of the world, there are civil codes that pretty much govern how your property would be distributed at your death. In France, for example, only about 10% of the population actually writes a personal will, because unless your estate value exceeds a certain discretionary amount, you don't have any choice in how your property is distributed. It just goes. And to wife, children equally, and so on. And if you lived in a country under Islamic law, that would determine how your property is divided, or other religious laws. So the idea of testamentary freedom actually comes through English common law to the United States and to the British Commonwealth, Canada, Australia, other Hong Kong, some other places. And it's got a very interesting history, which I discovered on doing research for the book. As a sociologist, you get to kind of follow a lot of trails. And it originated, actually, the idea in the Roman Republic of about 500 BC, when there was a set of laws that was adopted that told property owners, the patriarchs, what would happen if they died without a will. And because the major property owners were in charge of distributing their whole households, families, and so on, the idea of making a personal contract to make sure that it went to your heirs, that you wanted it to go, became a custom and a law then, and it kind of made its way through to England with the Roman invasion and occupation, sort of disappeared, of course, during the feudal years, came into effect later, and we brought it over, the English, in the colonies. So we have this inheritance, and it's still, however, a kind of a dual system, because if we don't write our own personal will, or have, you know, we die intestate, right? And actually, only about 2/3 of people who die in the United States actually have left a will. The rest have died intestate. So here's an interesting decision that you actually make. You have to decide one way or the other. If deciding not to write a will is actually a decision that your property is going to be distributed in a particular way as set by the statutes, California statutes one, all the different statutes are not all the same. But so if you die intestate, the state has a particular definition of who should inherit your property. You can look it up for California, dying intestate in California. Just Google that and you'll see what it is. So let me just conclude this part by saying that what this means in having testamentary freedom is that the issues of fairness arise because we are making decisions about who to give our property to, how much to give to each person, values, and so on and so forth. It's a heavy responsibility, and there are a lot of customary behaviors that are involved in this in terms of giving to your wife, giving to your children, etc. But what we want to talk about is what it means to have this kind of freedom and the choices that we make.
Well, thank you, Ruth. And Fred, do you have a perspective from the legal and the mediator and legal perspective on what fairness and what it is, why it matters?
Yes, and what's so interesting about what Ruth has done is that sort of in the trenches of dealing with resolving conflicts between siblings or resolving conflicts between siblings and a second wife or second husband or people who are in family-like relationships, oftentimes, at first, they don't use the concept of fairness. They may just say, I've been wronged, or I'm hurt, or I'm upset. But when I met Ruth and started hearing about her way of approaching it, I realized that her framework of fairness really encapsulates how all the people I deal with really think about what's happened. Because what they come to the table to say is that this wasn't fair.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about the conflicts that arise in post-death mediations is that the key decision maker is the one person who's not in the room. They're gone. So, and what's significant about that is that the way in which these perceptions of fairness emerge, let's just say people feel much more liberated in expressing their discontent when the person in power is not in the room. So where you often have, in fact, I'm seeing more and more of these conflicts with second spouses and children of the first spouse, where the children behave quite well while the elder is alive, often to the leading the elder to think there are no problems. And then when the let's say the gatekeeper is gone, or when, you know, when your mother's not around to judge your behavior, people become free to say things. And what I want to stress about that, and this is the key thing to think about since you're likely to be one of the decision makers as opposed to one of the heirs, is that you need to start the evaluation by trying to imagine what that conversation will be like when you're gone. And it's a very hard exercise because it means looking at your children or your spouse or your charity or your caregiver and try to see how they will feel when you're not around. And I have to say, you can't just call them up and ask them. Because inherent in the family dynamics is they're not going to tell you how they feel. The other, and this is what comes up so much when we talk about the emotionally intelligent estate plan, is that it requires that you look honestly at their situation. Why is this child broke? Why is this child in a marriage of somebody who's angry? Why is this child so unaccepting of my new spouse? It requires a kind of inquiry that can be very, very difficult. And part of the problem, and we're going to see how this comes up in our discussions throughout the hour, is that the people who are most supposedly the most ready to help you are you often the least able to deal with these issues. I give a talk of what I call the emotionally intelligent estate plan, as opposed to the tax maximizing estate plan. And, you know, I one of my lines about lawyers generally is that they think emotions are kind of like the Grand Canyon. If you get too close, you'll fall off and die. They just are not set up. There are exceptions like John, but most estate planners are reluctant. So if you have an estate planner who doesn't want to deal with these issues, and then you have a parent who is reluctant to deal with these issues, it's no surprise that I have so many clients come to me afterwards and say, this is not fair. So what you want to do to start this is imagine what's going to be said in the room when you're not there.
Good. Yes, I like to say you can talk about it directly now or they can act it out indirectly later. Those are the choices. And Ruth, what are they talking about when they say it's not fair?
Well, this is what's so interesting about the literature, because fairness basically seems to be in the eye of the beholder. And so what's fair to one person may not be fair to the other. It's really difficult to pin down what fairness means, even in general and in the abstract, because what's fair at one level can be very different at another level or from different points of view and so on. So, I mean, I was looking and researching the book on notions of fairness and social justice. And so here's an example of how difficult it is to really say what's fair and what's not when we're doing our estate planning, because here's a definition of fair means equitable, free from bias, dishonesty, or injustice, legitimately performed under the rules or standards, just or appropriate in the circumstances. So we're talking about passing on our inheritance as what's fair. We can think about what's fair in general, what's fair in the just or appropriate in the circumstances, treating people equally without favoritism or discrimination, impartial, unprejudiced, honest. On the other hand, justice, is one of the definitions, means giving each person what he or she deserves. And I love this part, because we can deserve a lot or we can deserve not very much, depending on how we've behaved or whether we're connected still with our families or whatever. So in more traditional terms, giving each person his or her due. And then we have the question of distributive justice across different people that we would like to give money to, and across groups in our society and so on. So there's real questions about what's just or unjust and what's fair or what's not fair. And we don't have any answers to this. We have just a lot of questions in the sense of this is the kind of thing that you really need to be negotiating. And as we go along, we'll talk about the idea of having family gatherings while you're still alive, in which you can hash out some of these different perspectives on what's fair or what's not. I mean, in the book, there it goes through a lot of discussions of the notions of fairness and social justice in our society, but we don't have time to talk about that here. It's just important for us, though, to understand that we may think that we're all being fair, but each person's definition of what's fair can be very, very different from another's, and I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Good. Thank you, Ruth. I guess there's the related question of like need, like how much how much money is going to expand my kid's life rather than destroy it, and at what age? So there's all kinds of big questions. And Fred, about choosing beneficiaries, friends, charities, family members, extended family members, lovers, what do you have to say, Fred?
Well, before I say that, I just want to just highlight something from what Ruth was talking about. And John, you just mentioned it, because I just want to make sure we see this intersection, which is the issue of deserving needy and undeserving needy. You have the issue of, and need can be relatively objective. This person doesn't have a house. This person doesn't have enough money to pay their bills. However, you know, there are people, I see a lot of them in my office, who, from my humble perspective, have great abundance, but, you know, they don't have two houses. They only have one. they, you know, have to work till they're 60, not till they're 50. People have very subjective notions of need. But the other issue which comes up so much is the question of deserving. And that really goes to the question of how did this person end up being needy? Was it bad job choice? Was it a physical disability? Was it a bad marriage? Was it underlying psychological problems? And that's where things become so subjective. So when I think about how do you make your way in this process and beneficiaries, I think of two circles. There's the circle of beneficiaries, and there's the circle of decision makers. There's some people who show up in both circles, but let me try to explain what I mean. If you think of your life and you think of yourself in the middle, you know, you can think of yourself with this big, you know, bucket of candy or goodies or whatever you want to talk about, and there is this circle. There is a spouse or a life partner. There's maybe a former spouse, a second former spouse, a new spouse, a partner. So there's a romantic connection. Then there are children. And though children is no longer very simple, you have your biological children. You have perhaps your spouses, your second spouse's children. You have people who've been in your life who you have a parent-child relationship with, maybe the child of your best friend who died young, maybe a niece or nephew who came to live with you, maybe somebody you've sponsored in a program helping underprivileged youth. You can have people who are in childlike relations. Then you have caregivers, you have friends, you have associates, and then you have the larger world. You have your church, the causes you care about. I'm somebody without children, and I refer to often, especially when I'm talking to my mother about inheritance, I talk about my causes as my children, who I believe are as deserving and certainly as needy as my siblings' children. So we can have a notion of our causes, and then we may have the larger community, the poor of our society, the poor of the world. And so that's your circle of beneficiaries, and you want to be thinking about, you know, how broadly do I want to spread my goods? How narrowly? In one direction or another. The other circle is the decision-making circle. And as I said, some people will show up in both. So your spouse probably will be part of the decision-making. We'll talk later about whether your children should be part of your decision-making. And for some people, especially depending on their level of wealth, their favorite charity may want to be a very active participant in their decision-making. And then you have people like caregivers who would like to have a say in the decision-making, or remote relatives who have kind of moved in and want to have a lot of influence. The thing to remember is you are the one who decides who comes into the room and where they sit in the room. And that applies both to the beneficiary circle and the decision-making circle. And as difficult as it is, the one thing that I don't think anyone will ever disagree with is that you hold the key to that door. Now, I don't want to suggest that that's an easy function to play. To turn to a family member and say you're not going to bequeath to them, or to turn to a caregiver and say, or even a spouse, a second spouse, and say, I'm not bringing you to the meeting with my lawyer. To exercise that control and that authority can be a very difficult thing. And I'll just end this section by saying what I've come to see as the most difficult is the new spouse and the children from the prior relations. I do a lot of mediation in that realm. And even the question of who comes to the meeting, who even initiates the discussion. I spoke to the son of someone who believes that his stepfather is bullying his mother financially. And one of the first things I said is, does the stepfather have a child? He said, yes. I said, you must invite your stepfather's child because you cannot get anywhere unless it's seen as both of our children of both of the parents are concerned. If you started out as just, I want to protect my mother against my stepfather, you've stepped off in an unbalanced situation.
Yes, and I've seen, you know, the patriarch can't stand up to anybody. So he promises everyone everything in a blended family, and then he dies, and of course there's a big fight. Ruth, what about equality and fairness in terms of leaving inheritance to adult children?
That's really an interesting question because in principle, we would think that leaving equal amounts to each of our adult children, that equality is the fairest principle. But and in fact, most of our practices, we do leave equal amounts to our children. But there are very good reasons to think of treating children differently and others who might inherit differently rather than the same, people who have different needs, different backgrounds, different concerns, and so on. So the whole question of equal versus equitable comes into our decisions, and it really gets kind of complicated. Also, it's a balancing act, and it's an issue of also looking at what children or others have been given during their lifetimes versus what you're going to be leaving at the time of your death, different ways of giving. Do you treat unequal people equally? Is that fair? Or treat equal people unequally? Is that fair? It's really kind of complicated trying to navigate these kinds of questions. Most of us don't even raise the questions because I think we go to attorneys who just sort of tell us what to do. Oh, well, these are your children and any other heirs and et cetera, and you just write it down. And but the whole idea of having our testamentary freedom means that we can make whatever decisions we want based on our own inclinations, our own ideas of what's fair, or even just our own prejudices. I mean, I talked to one friend about this work, and she said, well, fair schmear. I'm just going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to give everything to my daughter because my son, he can't stand him sort of thing, you know. So it's like we're talking lofty principles here, but I think sometimes in practice we sort of descend to the you know, I'm going to just do what I want to do. So the question has to do with bequests, let's say, whether we're going to treat let's say our adult children or our nieces and nephews, or whatever category, equally or unequally in our inheritance. And that's what we give them. And it's such an interesting question because we may have a certain sense that some of our children or adult children or nieces and nephews deserve more or they need more. There are so many different principles, each of which, in essence, is a kind of fair way of looking at things. So let me just go quickly over some of the choices. We might call these competing principles of fairness. And typically, we would probably give the same amount to each of the individuals, let's say each of our children or each of our nieces and nephews, each of people who fit into a particular category, saying that equal is fair, regardless of the differences in their needs or their just desserts or whatever. And that is typically what we, what most Americans do in their will. But we can also consider other issues having to do with giving to each according to their need. Some of our kids or our relatives may need more, others need less. But then the question arises as to why some may need more and some need less. Is it because some spend everything they get and others have saved? Or is it because of things that have happened to them that make someone genuinely needy, whereas another person isn't in that situation? Or maybe one child's married well and another hasn't, and so on and so forth. So there are so many different principles that we can follow. Balancing the scales of lifetime living. If you've given somebody a lot during their life, help give them a down payment on a house, paid for an expensive education, then should you compensate by giving the person who you've given less to more in your will, and so on? To each according to their just deserts. We have the deserving and the undeserving kids, some that paid attention to us, some that moved away. There are a number of different principles that one can follow, and each of them can be quite compelling to us. Each of them can be disputed by our heirs. So this gets to be a very interesting issue in terms of working out what is fair. And this is why we're going to propose that, if possible, while we're doing our estate planning, it would be very helpful to include our family members and others in some kind of conversation.
Yes, have the conflict sooner rather than later.
Yes.
while you can be there for the party. Fred, what about leaving assets such as retirement accounts and life insurance outside of a will and a trust?
Well, I want to get to that. Let me just quickly, before I get into that, add two more challenges to what Ruth was mentioning. One is, and we could have a whole separate anthropological and sociological discussion about spouses and in-laws. The whole question of, if you have children, what is the role of your children's spouses or partners? Are they amplifiers who come to the defense of their spouse who they feel has been wronged? Are they peacemakers? Are they included? Are they not included? I would say, of all the issues about who's going to come to a meeting, the issue of whether, you know, I don't want to let my sister-in-law in the room, I'm not going to come if my brother-in-law comes, the big. The second is, when Ruth was talking about need, it just occurred to me that, you know, not every family provides financial disclosures to all their family members. Very few do. So even the question of need. So, for example, you may have a kid who's got this fabulous house, but you don't know how close to bankruptcy that child really is. Or, you know, I had to be very careful as to when I was going to let my mother know what my billing rate per hour was. She's now very cute. She says, you know, can I have a half an hour of your time? Because I can't afford a full hour. So we can't assume that there's transparency in families. So I want to just make sure you know that. So the question John asks about retirement plans, also I want to tie it into the whole larger issue of time. There is what happens while you're alive in terms of gifts. There's what happens at your death or soon thereafter. And then there is what happens over a long time thereafter. So you can have generosity during your lifetime, making gifts, gifts of property, gifts of money, sending kids to college. You can have gifts while you're alive. You can also make distributions upon your death. But you can also then do more complicated things where you set up a trust for the benefit of one child and then to the grandchildren later. You can have a trust that has other people having control over it. You can give a retirement account that is only drawn out over time, an inherited IRA. And what I want to share with you is that one of the ways to address complexities of fairness is to think about generosity over time. And if you add the time dimension, at first it may seem very burdensome, but actually it can open up opportunities. And the one component about it that we think that we find quite fascinating is that there is often a response to need during lifetime that seems easy to do. Not easy, but the right thing to do. You know, your kid's been in an accident, your grandson finally at age 30 decides to go to college and there's no money for that, your daughter-in-law's business fails, a certain charity you care about needs. So people tend to be more willing to be generous in that moment. If you ask them to say, well, I noticed that your kid never saved any money, are you willing to give them $100,000 more than your other kids? There's a, let's just say there's a less immediate response and often a more thoughtful response, which is a good thing. And then similarly, if you feel that you have children who are not financially responsible, even if they are 30 or 40 or 50, what you set up in terms of restricting what access do they have to the funds, and one really crucial piece, which we'll talk a little bit more later, but I just want to highlight it here, is the very difficult question of who is the trustee. Is it, and it's one thing to be the trustee, I was recently trustee of an aunt, where everything was distributed within a year. It was mostly a clerical task. You start having a situation where you have a disabled child, or a spendthrift daughter, or an irresponsible sibling. There you're thinking about who is going to be administering that estate. And if you think about it, in some ways, they are going to be the guardian of fairness. What's fair in terms of how much money do you give that person if there's a second generation that is also there? Or what is prudent if the money is supposed to last a long time? So think about time and think about who is managing this distribution over time, because those are really important, let's just say, nuances of the overall fairness decision.
Yes, and be sure your documents are drafted to include whatever flexibility you want about the trustees' obligation to make distributions over time.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Ruth, what about the family fights, the family conversations, and what is equal and what, I mean, really, what, who needs to know what, who needs to be in on the fight, and the awkwardness of like changing your trust after you, 5 years after you announced you're going to do it a certain way?
Well, that's a heavy question, because we're all dealing with different kinds of families, different kinds of relationships, different economic situations in our own lives. So we're considering our own evolution, partnerships breaking up, remarriages when we're working on our wills, our economic situations change, those of our kids change a lot, our friends that we want to include perhaps or not, our charities that we want to include. Our lives tend to be in major flux, which means that at the most practical aspect of this is that we really need to relook and rethink at what our decisions are every 2 or 3 years to see if they're still valid, for one thing, because our everyone's lives change, and we need to be aware of what the contingencies may be. So there's always a big question of how much we want to share of our own plans with our kids or with our grandkids or with our siblings or whatever. And we tend to be in the sort of on the side of having family conversations about these things, but that may not always be relevant, and it may be something that you don't feel comfortable in doing. Or many people feel that, you know, writing a will or making an estate plan is a private thing, and when you die, your heirs will find out what they're going to do, get or not get, and it's no longer there. Your problem. But we're kind of interested in the notion of at least a little negotiation, even though when you're the testator and you're writing your will, it's your decision. It is your decision. You can disinherit, you can include people, you can do your favorite charities, you can give everything to charity. I mean, there's certain rules about what you actually own and what you have to know that. And it's very important that you know exactly what is yours to give away or to write in your will, you know, community property and so on. That all has very important implications here in California. But the range of possibilities is quite broad in terms of how much you want to share about your decisions with those who are closest to you and who you want to include in this decision making. And I did a lot of reading on what kind of advice is given, and it ranges from try to include everybody who's possibly affected to don't tell anybody what your plans are. First of all, they might change. Secondly, nobody really has a right to know. Obviously, you need to consult if you're going to invite someone to be your executor. You have to get their permission and so on. So there's a whole range of opinion, and that really depends on what each of us is comfortable with doing and what we want to share. And then the questions arise as to whether the sharing involves just our informing our family or other interested members, friends, this is what I've decided to do. I just want to let you know. Or you can go a little further and say, this is what I'm thinking about doing. I really appreciate your input into this because I'm not sure whether I'm really reflecting people's different needs and different concerns. And it is my decision in the end. I need you to know that. But I want to know what your perception is, because sometimes you can find out that people even in your family have debts that you had no idea about or income. And also it depends on what your own notion of kind of what's fair is going to be. So there are a lot of different models that one can follow in this whole process. And we basically are on the side of encouraging each of us to actually talk with our families and to get some kind of feedback and to invite consultation as to what you think is fair or what is not fair among different people. Understanding that, again, you as the testator, each of us as the testator, has the absolute authority to make whatever decision that we want within the confines of the law, obviously. But that's what's so interesting about this notion of testamentary freedom, is if you think your kids are well off, they're doing just fine, then are you obligated to give everything still to them, or would you like to indulge in your favorite charities or really, you know, save the whales or contribute to a political party or do something that really matters? And so these are our decisions, and the notions of fairness, what's fair and what's not, are so interesting, but they can also be in the eye of the beholder. And so it's a fascinating, I think, a conversation to have about what's fair and what's not in family inheritance, because each of us is likely to come in with a different notion of what that means. And it's really helpful to try to negotiate that ahead of time.
Yes, Ruth. And, you know, when the kids or other family members have been in on the conversation about what they might inherit, on what terms, and they feel like, you know, they've been heard in the planning process, and they know what to expect when dad dies. They're not likely to fight. But when it's a surprise, dad died and left everybody else more than me, I'm pissed. Because everybody's entitled. It's like, you know, there's a book called Mommy Loved Me Best. It's like, it's really a sense of entitlement, which is why less than equal can kind of damage, if you do it less than equally, even for a good reason, it can damage the relationship between the siblings, because the one who didn't get an equal share may never, you know, may hold it against those who got more. And sometimes they want the others to, like, reimburse them for their share. Yeah.
Or sometimes people voluntarily reimburse.
I've seen that too. Fred, what about dealing with all this family conflict, you know, in the estate planning process, and when the battles begin after the death?
Yes. So, first of all, one of the contexts to think of, and this is something that Ruth and I have talked a lot about, is to think about, first of all, from a sociological or family dynamics perspective, how does your family work? And one thing I want to just point out, as I was listening to this, I was thinking, one of the things we don't talk a lot about is gender. And gender is a very important factor here. So, for example, is it the patriarch or is it the matriarch? And what is the mother's role? What is the father's role? When one predeceased the other, how does that change? If one predeceases the other and then gets remarried, there's another person. And just sort of be mindful, or for example, in the next generation, the husband, the wife, be just mindful that family structures are often gendered in a way that affects decision making. So a lot of people in my field talk about these things as family conversations or family consultation. I use the term mediation. Mediation sometimes is charged because mediation implies you're trying to resolve a conflict. Yeah. And these folks don't even want to accept that they have a conflict. I mean, people say, like, well, we have no conflict. He's just a jerk. You know, right. There's no conflict. I'm right. He's wrong. Where's the conflict? So the way I talk about it is, how do we structure a family discussion that will lead to better decision making? And I'll just give you two examples as models that I have used. One involved a question of a very, very valuable asset that had been in the family. It was a piece of property that had been a family compound for over 100 years. And the matriarch, after the husband had died, was very troubled about what to do about this, whether to sell it, whether to keep it, whether to distribute it, whether to divide it. And she had named two of her five siblings as her successor trustees. So she was in charge now. There were two that were going to be in charge upon her death. And then there were three others. And they decided they wanted to involve the whole family. And so the first thing I did for them was a legal analysis of who's in charge. So everybody was clear, mom's in charge now, they have rights later, others do not have decision-making authority. We also, and I worked also with her as a coach for her, of how to even open the discussion about why she wanted to have this meeting. And we explored what the different options were. And as I interviewed her, and this is part of what we all do in this field, we don't just have everybody come in the room and say, what's going on? So, for example, in this case, I interviewed her privately about what her fears were and what her concerns were. She then authorized me to interview each of her children privately, and she wrote to them to ask them. And, for example, one of them revealed to me that They had suffered terrible financial losses. They have a disabled child, and she desperately needed the money. But she had never told her siblings what was happening because she was so embarrassed. There was also a sibling who was furious that she had not been named executor because she was older than the one that was named, and her notion of fairness is that seniority should rule. She didn't realize that her mother thought, oh, I don't want to burden her, and thought the other one who didn't have kids and was more available would not be burdened so much. So we had the private discussions, and then we met. And what was so important is the first meeting, I asked each of them, what would you do if you were completely in charge? And what would your goals be? The problem with this family, every one of them said, I would want to do the thing that made everyone else the happiest. They were so wonderfully generous with each other that it was very hard actually to get them to talk about their own needs. But eventually, and I can just tell you, it became very emotional, especially when the one revealed what she had never told her siblings about her needs. And so we had a session that was just about the needs. And let me just say that I introduced the session by saying, your mother is in charge of the decision making, but she cares about how you feel. So we always made it clear who was the decision maker and who had a say. And what was so wonderful about this is then I met privately with the mother and her two executors, her successor trustees, and they entered into a decision-making process that took over a year. There were appraisers involved. There were lawyers involved. This is a very complicated property. And then they came to a decision. And we then had another structured conversation about how they were going to convey the decision. And one of the things that was so important is when they made the decision, which was to sell, they actually worked out a script, so you would say, of what to say to the people they knew would be disappointed. And it was so interesting because they were very wonderful. The mother would call me and say, I'm about to send this email to my kids. Will you read it before I send it? She was wonderful. And I would say, you know, she would say things like, I want to have a meeting so we can all talk about the decision we're going to make. And I said, no, it's the decision you're going to make. You need to own the fact that you're the decision maker.
That's a hard thing for
and
a lot of people.
And she did. And what was so wonderful is that when we had the meeting, people expressed their disappointment. They expressed their sadness. And what was so sweet is at one point one of them said, well, can you wait 6 months so we can have one more family gathering? And I then, out of the blue, I was starting to cry at this point. And I said, will you hire a videographer? This property has been in the family for 120 years. It would be so wonderful to create a video history of telling the stories and have that to honor that memory. And they all loved that. In fact, they did that. So this is an example of where we actually, they reached a consensus through this process. And let me just give one other example, which is that I've been doing in numerous instances lately, which is that when I have elder couple, in this case, generally it's where it's a second or third marriage, and they are trying to make a decision about their estate planning, that we have a meeting where each of them brings one of their siblings to the meeting. And we make it clear that the sibling is not a decision maker, but is there to voice their concerns. And it's risky. It can be very scary. It can open up wounds that are very difficult to manage. And let me just pause it and say, in some instances, it is more appropriate to have a therapist as the convener of the meeting rather than one of us lawyers who likes to think we're emotionally intelligent but may not be a family therapist. I will say in most of my work, if you tell people we're going to go to a family therapist, they won't go. If you say, come to the lawyer, we're going to have a discussion, they'll come.
And you can have a therapist in the room. The communication specialist, yes, is the way some of us relabel the therapist in any event. Denise.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to The Fundamental Challenge of Planning Your Estate, What's Fair in Family Inheritance. Our thanks to Ruth Dixon Mueller, Fred Hertz, and your moderator, John O'Grady. I'm Denise Michaud, co-chair of the Grownups Forum, and I'll be moderating today's question-answer period. John, I think we have a large number of questions.
Thank you, Denise. Before we get to questions, let me say that you should each have 3 handouts. And for the online audience, if you contact us, we'll be happy to email them to you. Denise will provide our contact info for you later. There's also, for the people who came in late, I have a popular estate planning newsletter and the sign-up sheet's going around, so please find it if you're interested. And the first question. The question is, should you spend your retirement account money or let someone inherit it? And what about second-to-die life insurance policies? Your questions are really for an estate lawyer like me. They're a little off the topic of equality. Yeah, I'll give you my card. But do either of you have anything to say to these questions?
No, I think that's better left to a discussion. We're going to be here after the formal program ends, and that's a perfect time to ask that question.
Yes. So this is not a program on, you know, exactly how to do your estate planning. It's more specific about equality and fairness, but it is a very good question, and I'll be happy to talk to you later.
So I've heard that you should only have one trustee, but in terms of equality, wouldn't it be better if you have a blended family to have one representative from each side of the family to assist with that function?
So I'm a huge fan of never more than one trustee.
I second the motion.
It's true that there is a tension, and giving someone power means that they need to honor the other perspectives, and you want to be thoughtful in your selection of a trustee. And you can even put things into your trust about duties to disclose, duties to confer. But I think that it's really important to avoid extremely painful fights over what might be very small issues, that you allow for one person to be in charge.
And I think it's a bad, I don't think it's wise to assume that an adult child is a good choice of trustee, yeah, even though most of my clients think so when they first walk in the room with me. Most of them end up choosing someone else.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for the great discussion today. Our question is, you talked earlier about, you know, it's better to have the fights now versus people being surprised, you know, after the person has passed away. But is there a way to actually avoid that even by, you know, making the disclosures to each beneficiary something that is not shared with all beneficiaries? And it's only if the beneficiaries themselves were to talk with one another that they would know, oh, I got this amount, this person got that amount.
Oh, everybody's...
Ruth, answer that one.
Everybody's entitled to a copy of the trust, so you can't do it that way.
She's saying while you're alive.
I didn't quite get the question.
Is the question, are you in favor of a private disclosure to each beneficiary while you're alive, or are you suggesting upon death?
It was upon death, so that I don't want to have the discussion now. And is there a way to avoid the conflict after?
No. Everybody's entitled to a copy of the trust. Everybody named in the trust is entitled to a copy of it after the death. But sometimes people get around that by leaving everything to a trusted loved one who has informal instructions about how to dole it out. But that's a very risky move. And they might die before you.
Well, let me just add a comment, too, that I think one of the most difficult issues that arises is that when equal, if we're talking about our children or some similar category, when equal isn't really equitable, that's where a lot of conflict can arise. Equitable means that each person according to his or her due or what that person deserves or needs. And equal means equal regardless of all of these other factors. And those are two really difficult tensions, I think. What often happens in the estate planning, I think, is that when we write our wills, we might give children, stepchildren, whatever, equally, but give them very unequally during their lifetimes. So there's a sort of balancing the scales there. Not balancing the scales, but whoever needs more during their lifetime you give, then it's very symbolic that they get equal at the end. But there are good reasons to say that maybe you want to balance the scales at the end and give different and so on. So equal and equitable are two very different concepts, and they really can clash.
I just want to tell you one strategy that a client of mine did come up with is that she started making very unequal gifts in the last years of her lifetime. And unlike her checkbook, which otherwise meticulously had every dollar she spent for those items, it was blank as to what the amount of the gift was. So that even when her children opened her desk and found her checkbook, they couldn't see how much they had been given. Some of them figured it out and they weren't happy. But that was one strategy someone used to keep that confidentiality.
Yes, there are others.
You all have been talking in terms of an individual, if I understood, individual as trustee. How do you feel about an institution rather than an individual?
Now, John, why don't you take that one?
Generally, the institutions are really serving as trustees so they can move all your money to their bank. And they do the job right, but they do it. It's expensive. They're highly bureaucratic. They're highly inflexible. But for certain people, a bank is a good choice. But usually, they're not going to even consider it unless you have a few million or more that they can move to their bank.
So let me just say, I very much disagree with John. I've actually served as the real estate attorney for numerous bank trusts dealing with things, and I find the trust officers to actually take their job very seriously. And I've dealt with two situations where a bank was chosen for two very important reasons. One is they felt that only a professional would have the emotional strength to say no to a needy, demanding child. And when the bank trustee says, this trust is supposed to last for 40 years, so you're only getting $50,000 a year, that banker can do that in a way that the person's sister or brother might not have the fortitude to do that. And the second has to do with longevity. If you're I have several family members for which this is an issue. If you're looking at setting up a trust for a 20-year-old where it's never going to be distributed in its entirety, there may not be a competent adult who's going to be around for 60 years. So I think it's a great solution. Let me just also add, separate from banks, there are private fiduciaries, and I've worked with a lot of them, and oftentimes they can only be picked by a bank or by an heir upon death because you don't know who's going to be in business in 20 years. But there are some private fiduciaries out there who do excellent work.
Yes, I work with several of them. I think we may be out of time, Denise, are we?
Yes, we have reached the point in our program where we have time for one last question.
You, in referring to inequality and equitable, would you run into problems where if money had been distributed according to need while the adults were alive, the older ones were alive, and then made it just totally equal all the way around. Has that, because you've, at the end, in other words, when you give what's left to the kids and you make everything equal, even though you've perhaps doled out money to different kids for different needs earlier in their lives, you've dealt with all these, you said, with fights and that sort of thing. Does that create fights? Is there some attempt? Should you make some attempt to even that out at the end?
I'm going to just turn over to Ruth in a second. Let me just say the issue of whether to equalize interview during your life giving is probably the biggest source and the most recurring problem where people say you didn't adjust for that.
But typically, you'll see in one of the chapters we have in the book, which I hope you'll look at because it's available online, it's that typically what happens is that exactly what you're talking about. We will treat our children or heirs of a particular category unequally according to their needs during their lifetime. Someone needs a loan for this, for the house, tuition, help with this. They hit up bad times. And then when it comes to writing our will, we treat them equally. Sometimes we don't even share the information as who's getting what. And so having equal treatment in a will seems to be very symbolic.
Thank you. And before we close, can each of you give our listening audience a way to contact you? Ruth?
Oh, I guess by email, DixonMueller@yahoo.com. That's DixonMueller.
Or by Googling her book, available through Amazon, Passing On, What's Fair in Family Inheritance.
And Fred?
And I'm Fred at FrederickHertz.com. And you can also find me, Frederick Hertz, on the handout. And also, you can find me through Cal Bar, California Bar Association, Frederick Hertz in Oakland.
And John.
And my newsletter and I, we are available at john@ogradylaw.com, no apostrophe, ogradylaw.com.
Our thanks to Ruth Dixon Mueller, Frederick Hertz, and your moderator, John O'Grady, for their comments here tonight. We also thank our audience here and as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 115th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.